and soldiers are stationed. Meanwhile, a controversial law that critics claim gives men in Afghanistan's Shiite minority the right to rape their wives has been put on hold. A Justice Ministry official says that representatives of the American and Canadian embassies, the United Nations, European Union, and NATO will help review the law to make sure it doesn't violate international human rights standards. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.
A new report on airline quality says the nation's air carriers turned in their best performance in 4 years in 2008. Topping the ratings were Hawaiian Airlines, followed by AirTran and JetBlue. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 141 points. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Citgo. With nearly 7,000 locally owned and independently operated stations, Citgo offers neighborhood support for local communities across the country.
Are these people in your carpool?
This is David Inge.
I'm Celeste Quinn.
I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Carl Castle from NPR News. Beep, beep,
beep, beep, yeah. Whether you're coming or going, you depend on us to keep you company. We depend on you for financial support to make that possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to help make great programs possible on WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
Support for programs on WILL comes from the Beckman Institute on the U of I campus. The Beckman Institute 20th Anniversary Celebration will be held on Thursday, April 16th, beginning at 3 p.m. in the Beckman Institute Auditorium. The celebration is open to the public.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show are Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour Focus, we're going to the archives for the program. That's a show that we first broadcast January 6th. So as you listen, do keep in mind that during this hour, we'll not be taking calls. In 1835, a small New York City newspaper called The Sun published a series of articles revealing that there was life on the moon, including unicorns, beavers that walked upright on their hind legs, and four-foot-tall flying man bats. Within a few weeks, this paper, The Sun, became the most widely read newspaper in the world. This morning, in this hour, we'll bring you the story of what may well be the most successful newspaper hoax in history. It is the subject of Matthew Goodman's recent book. The title is The Sun and the Moon, and it has kind of a long subtitle, and that is The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. It's published by Basic Books, and it is a very interesting story. Matthew Goodman's nonfiction has appeared in a number of places, including The Foreword, The American Scholar, Harvard Review, Brill's Content, The Etney Reader. He's also the author of the book Jewish Food, The World at the Table. And he makes his home in Brooklyn, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Goodman, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing fine.
Well, I appreciate it, and appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thanks so much.
You know, I think, as I've said before here on this program, one of the great things for me is always the opportunity to learn things and read about things that were completely new, that I had never heard of before. And certainly the Sun newspaper's lunar hoax is on that list, completely new to me, and it's such a great story.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'll tell you something, it was totally new to me until I happened across it one day. I happened to be reading a book of New York history, and I saw a reference to something called the Great Moon Hoax. And I said, you know, what's that? And I discovered that, as you mentioned, in the summer of 1835, the Sun newspaper published a series of six articles claiming that life had been discovered on the moon by way of this supposedly very powerful new telescope invented by the British astronomer Sir John Herschel, and had discovered all of those various creatures that you enumerated earlier, including unicorns and biped beavers and, most astonishing of all, these four-foot-tall man-bats, Vespertilio Homo, Sir John Herschel is said to have dubbed them, that flew and talked and did art and built temples and, according to the Sun, fornicated in public, although that was a subject they didn't go into in great detail, this being the Victorian era. And I said, my goodness, how, you know, this is an amazing story. How is it I've never heard anything about this? And, of course, I did, you know, what the 21st century writer does, which is, you know, I went to Google immediately and, you know, Wikipedia and all the other sites, and no one indeed had ever written a book about it. So I said, okay, that's my book.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you wondered, and we'll talk some more about this because there are many interesting features. It says something about the newspaper business as it was then and as it would become, and maybe it says something about people's appetite for stories like this. Well, one of the things that you wonder as you look at how this story spread around the world, and people just could not get enough of this.
That's right.
You wonder, did people actually believe that this was true and that there were man-bats on the moon, or was it just it was a very entertaining story, and for that reason people were reading it, and maybe they didn't care whether it was true or not. They just thought, well, this is a great story.
Well, that's a really interesting and excellent question. The contemporaneous accounts suggest that people, in fact, did believe it.
Hmm.
Of course, they were highly entertained by it. They were an extremely well-written set of stories that were written, as it turns out, although, of course, people didn't know this at the time, written by the editor of The Sun, a guy named Richard Adams Locke, an expatriate British journalist, who was a really erudite guy, very intelligent, especially in the realm of science. He was an astronomy buff, and he filled the stories full of all kinds of realistic-seeming technical details that gave it the real kind of veneer of authenticity. But part of the reason why people believed it, and this is something that I found perhaps most fascinating in researching this book, is that these articles confirmed what people already believed, which is that the moon was inhabited. The astronomers of the time were a very religious lot, and they believed that the moon was inhabited, but not just the moon. All of the planets were inhabited, all of the stars, even the sun itself was inhabited, because God, in his infinite wisdom, would not create these beautiful heavenly worlds without also creating intelligent beings there to appreciate them. This was the sort of general consensus in the astronomical community of the time. And so when people discovered that there was life on the moon, it just confirmed what they already believed, and thus was doubly delightful for that.
Mm. And this gets at the maybe we're getting ahead of the story here, but I suppose this in part gets at the motivation.
That's right.
Of Richard Locke. And one might look at this and say, well, maybe this was just a scheme to perpetrate a hoax that would result in enormous circulation boost for the paper, which, of course, it did. But that really wasn't apparently the reason that he wrote this.
Exactly. That's the amazing thing that I ultimately discovered. You know, the general feeling about the hoax, when it's been written about occasionally here and there over the years, is that it was simply designed to sell more papers for The Sun. The Sun was a sort of an upstart paper, just 2 years old, kind of a working class paper. And I think for the publisher of The Sun, a guy named Benjamin Day, I think that really was his motivation to sell papers, which the series did brilliantly. As you mentioned, by the time the series was over, The Sun was the most widely read newspaper in the entire world. Not just in New York and not just in the country, but in the entire world. So it certainly did sell papers. But as I've discovered, the motivation of the man who actually wrote the series, this guy Richard Adams Locke, was actually quite different. I did a lot of research into the life of Richard Adams Locke, which really hadn't been known very much before this. He was sort of an enigmatic guy. It turns out Richard Adams Locke was a radical, a political radical, whose views had caused him to be fired from his job in Somerset, England. At the time, he was a champion of Catholic emancipation, which was very controversial, and so forth. And he eventually left England entirely, and he came to New York looking for work. At The Sun, he was a great opponent of slavery, which was very unusual in New York in the 1830s. It was hard to find abolitionists in New York in the 1830s. So Richard Adams Locke's editorials were actually quite courageous. He was almost unique among newspaper editors in his opposition to Southern slavery. But he also was a great believer in science, in modern science, and in the liberatory power of science. He was a religious free thinker, something of a religious dissident, and he was deeply concerned by any attempt by religion to control science, to influence the free play of science. He was very distressed, for instance. He had two young geologist friends who had actually given up their research because it was leading them to the inescapable conclusion that the Earth was, in fact, millions of years old and not just a few thousand years old, as the biblical scholars of the time claimed. Well, he was very upset by this, and he was deeply distressed by these religious astronomers and this idea of that all of these planets must be inhabited because God made it so. He saw correctly that this was just religion masquerading as science. And so he decided to write these articles as a satire of the popular religious astronomy of the time. You know, he said, if they believe that there's life on the moon, I'll give them an inhabited moon. And if they believe that these creatures are Christian, then I will give them lunar man bats who build temples and so forth. And write it all in the kind of high-flown, showy scientific language that these astronomers themselves used, and in so doing, expose this for the nonsense that it was. But what he hadn't anticipated was that people had been so schooled in the ideas of the religious astronomers that when the series came out, they simply believed the articles. They simply believed them. And then when they found out that it wasn't true, they claimed it was a hoax. But in point of fact, it was not a hoax. It was a satire. And Richard Adams Locke was, in fact, disappointed by the reaction that the series had gotten. He confided to one of his friends later that he himself was the best self-hoaxed man in New York.
If you want to read about this, by the way, you should look for the book that is titled The Sun and the Moon by our guest Matthew Goodman. It tells the story of the what has come to be known as the lunar hoax, the great lunar hoax, a series of articles that were published in the New York Sun newspaper in late summer of 1835, and it is a very good story. We have a caller here. Others certainly are welcome to call in with questions, comments. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and we have someone here in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering how much of that hoax was stimulated by the hoax of the Cardiff Giant, which was also popular, I think, about that time. The Cardiff Giant was, there was a minister whose peculiar reading of Revelations convinced him that the world was inhabited by giants, and there was some farmer, I think in upstate New York, that made a concrete giant and buried it in one of his fields so he could run across it when he was plowing, and before he got the thing built or buried, he was already putting up a ticket booth to sell tickets.
That's right.
And to make the story even better, P.T. Barnum tried to get a hold of the Cardiff Giant, but they had destroyed it. So P.T. Barnum made a copy of the fake Cardiff Giant for him to put on display. But it's peculiar that this hoax you're talking about and the Cardiff Giant sort of falls in together. And I'm wondering whether these guys sat back and said, well, look, these guys, these fools up in, out there in the public will fall for the Cardiff Giant. Why not have them fall for this sort of thing?
Well, you know, you make a very interesting point. The Cardiff Giant actually came after the moon hoax.
It did.
It was some years later. But your point is a very good one because the two hoaxes are connected by a number of things, not just the fact that they both took place in New York, and not just the fact that there were some religious motivations behind both of the hoaxes, but also the fact that they were both, in both hoaxes was involved none other than P.T. Barnum, Phineas Taylor Barnum, who was one of the major who's actually one of the major characters in my book. He had come to New York as a young showman the very same month that the moon hoax was published in The Sun, August of 1835, a young would-be showman out of rural Connecticut, Bethel, Connecticut. And he had with him his first hoax. A woman, an elderly African-American woman, a slave by the name of Joyce Heth, who he claimed...
The nursemaid of George Washington, I believe.
What's that?
Wasn't she supposed to be the nursemaid of George Washington?
That's exactly right. He claimed that she was 161 years old. And not only that, but that she was, in fact, the nursemaid of the infant George Washington in the cradle. And he plastered New York with publicity about the female Methuselah, as he called her. And he put her on display at an entertainment spot in New York called Niblo's Garden. And New Yorkers swarmed by the thousands to come see Joyce Heth and to listen to her tell her tales of young George Washington, including the tale of the cherry tree, which in her memory was a pear tree. It was the greatest hoax of its time until 2 weeks later when the Sun hoax occurred. The Joyce Heth hoax, by the way, was exposed by none other than Richard Adams Locke in the Sun. And P.T. Barnum became actually friendly with Richard Adams Locke. So there was a whole sort of web of hoaxes and counter hoaxes that were going on at this time. This was really the time of hoaxes. This was the time of great hoaxes. Americans loved hoaxes, and they delighted in them. And, you know, P.T. Barnum built his brilliant career on the back of hoaxes. And when people finally discovered that the Sun series was a hoax, they didn't turn against the Sun, as people suspected that they would. They simply tipped their hats to the great hoaxsters of the Sun and said, you know, well done, job well done, and they continued to buy the Sun, and the Sun circulation never went back down as a result of this hoax.
Yeah, my favorite P.T. Barnum minor hoax was he wanted to get people moving through his displays as quickly as possible, so he put up a sign saying, this way to the egress.
Right.
Thanks.
All right, thank you for the call. Sure, other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. You know, there's another part of this that has to do with the history of newspapering in the United States. And as you point out in the book, that at this time in the early 1830s in New York City, there were 11 daily papers, but the circulation was relatively small, and that was apparently because for most people, a newspaper was just too expensive. They, you know, they didn't have the money to spend on it. It cost 6 cents, all of 6 cents to buy a paper, and you had to subscribe, which meant you had to pay your money up front.
That's
and
right.
That the man who started the Sun, a man named Benjamin Day, apparently had this idea. It had been tried before, but he was the first one to make it work, mm-hmm. that you could print a newspaper and charge a penny and get a much wider readership from less affluent people because it was a whole lot cheaper than the other papers.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's a big part of the early sections of my book is about the beginnings of the newspaper industry in New York, which in terms of the newspapers as a mass medium really began with the Sun. As you said, in the 1830s, the early 1830s, there were 11 daily newspapers in New York, 7 morning papers, 4 afternoon papers. But they only had a combined circulation of about 26,000. This is in a city of more than 250,000 people. They really weren't meant for the average people, for the, you know, working men and women. As you said, they cost 6 cents a copy, which doesn't sound like a lot to us today, but you know, in point of fact, it was a great deal of money at the time. They were known as merchants' papers. They were meant for the upper class of the city, the merchants, the aristocrats. And the kinds of articles that they published were really the kinds of things that merchants would be interested in, you know, articles about commodity prices and the international economic situation and ships, launchings and arrivals and so forth. So Benjamin Day, who was by no means upper class, he was a young working class printer in New York, had an idea for a very different kind of newspaper. It was only going to cost 1 cent instead of 6 cents. That's the origin of the phrase penny paper. And it was going to have the kinds of articles that he thought most New Yorkers actually wanted to read. So, for instance, he had a lot of crime stories. they were probably the most popular part of the paper. They took up most of the news page of the paper. People loved those stories. But not just crime stories, also a lot of local coverage, which the merchant papers really didn't have. People loved to know about what was going on in their own neighborhoods. Entertainment news, sports news, gossip, scandal, and so forth. You know, very much the kinds of stuff that we associate with, you know, good local papers today. You know, the template for that really began with Benjamin Day and the Sun in the year 1835, and it, you know, quickly became a very popular paper. It was a revolutionary new paper. And as you mentioned, newspapers up to that point had only ever been sold by subscription. The newspaper editors of the time, who considered themselves, you know, great gentlemen, thought it was beneath them to hawk papers on the street like, you know, like apples or muffins or something. And Benjamin Day said, no, we're going to have a new way of selling this new kind of paper. And he hired the first newsboys. And they went out and hawked the paper on the streets. And they soon became, you know, a regular part of daily life in New York. And, you know, they did so well for the Sun that other newspapers began to follow the Sun's lead. And soon you had, you know, just scads of newsboys on the streets of New York, and it changed not just the newspaper business, but really the life of the city forever.
Yeah, I love that aspect of the story. It was another thing, of course, that I would not have known. This iconic figure of the boy hawking the papers on the corner, shouting out, you know, things like sensational murder and fire kills family, and
right.
You know, this and that and the other thing that
they had figured out that those were the headlines that worked best to get people's attention. Exactly.
Yeah. And again, our guest in this hour of the show, Matthew Goodman. His book is The Sun and the Moon. It's published by Basic Books and is out now. It's a good story. You can go out to the bookstore and look for it. Questions, welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe can you talk a little bit more about some of the details of the stories? And do we know... as far as Richard Adams Locke was concerned, where exactly he got the inspiration for some of the things, some of these strange and odd things that he put into the story?
Mm-hmm. Well, his immediate inspiration was an article that he had read in a Scottish scientific journal a few years earlier. The Sun, by the way, claimed that they were getting their information, they were reprinting these articles from the Edinburgh Journal of Science, from a Scottish scientific journal, that was the source, supposedly.
Was there, in fact, such a journal, or did he make that up?
There was indeed such a journal. The title was a little bit different, and I think he was intending it to be this journal that he had first read this particular article some years earlier, which was titled "The Moon and Its Inhabitants." Which was, as I mentioned, you know, many, if not all, of the astronomers of the time believed in an inhabited moon, or at least believed it was possible. And this article, "The Moon and Its Inhabitants," described the efforts that were then being made by a number of European astronomers to contact the inhabitants of the moon, the lunarians, by means of various stratagems, or at least their thoughts about how to do it, by way of you know, building a large geometric figure on the plains of Siberia, or digging a huge trench and filling it with kerosene and lighting it, you know, as a way to communicate, you know, to say hello up there, you know, to our neighbors on the moon. So that was the immediate inspiration for Locke's series. In terms of how he populated the moon and the various, you know, the scenery that he created on the moon, that seems to have come simply out of his imagination. He had a very fertile imagination, and you know, he filled the moon with seas and waterfalls and mountains and forests and sheep and waterfowl, and you know, he created a very vivid world on the moon, which is part of what gave these articles their tremendous verisimilitude, why people really believed it, because it seemed so lifelike.
Yeah, I think probably also one of the things that gave it this the feeling of reality, in addition to the fact that he cited something that sounded like it was an actual journal, the Scottish Scientific Journal, was the fact that he attached the name of John Herschel to it.
That's right.
Who was indeed a real and very famous, well-known astronomer.
That's right. That absolutely right. John Herschel was indeed a real astronomer. He was a very eminent astronomer, probably the most famous astronomer in the world at that time. His fame has, in the 19th century, has been compared to Einstein's in the 20th century. He was the son of an equally well-known astronomer, a guy named William Herschel, who was the king's astronomer in England. He had discovered the planet Uranus. But John Herschel was a very well-known astronomer in his own right, and was at the time living in South Africa. He had built an observatory in South Africa to survey the southern skies, much as his father had done with the northern skies. This was very convenient for Richard Adams Locke. Locke, of course, who was an astronomy buff, knew that Herschel was in South Africa. This is, of course, the days before the telegram, which meant that it would take months to get word to Herschel of the discoveries that were being claimed in his name. And thus, it would be a long time before Herschel would be able to deny that indeed he had made any of these discoveries. But yes, as you say, the fact that they were being attributed to this real man gave even greater authenticity to these stories.
Well, then one of the questions, obviously, is how it is that Herschel felt about having his name attached to this hoax.
That's right. Well, the way he discovered it was that there was a guy named Caleb Weeks, who was the owner of a circus in New York, a traveling circus. He was the person who had first introduced the giraffe to the United States, had shipped the giraffe over from Africa. And he had gone to South Africa to look for more animals for his circus. And he happened to be staying in Johannesburg at the very same hotel where John Herschel always took his afternoon tea. And, you know, he went up to Herschel and congratulated him on his great lunar discoveries. And Herschel said, well, what discoveries do you mean? And Caleb Weeks brought out the series of newspapers that had the lunar discovery series in them. And Herschel read them with a growing sense of wonder and interest and astonishment. And, Herschel was really sort of a great guy. You know, he had a great sense of humor. He was an amazingly cultured, sophisticated man. And his first reaction was really amusement. He thought it was very well done, the series. And he sort of took it, you know, in good humor. But as time went on, and as he began to get letters from all around the world, day after day, in all different languages, English and German and French and Italian and so forth, asking him about, you know, what more discoveries he had made and when are you going to tell us about your even greater discoveries, he began to get less amused by it, probably much more irate, I guess you would say, that his name, his good family name had been wrapped up in this bit of nonsense as he thought of it.
Mm. Another part of the story, I think, is as we have discussed a little bit, is about the newspaper business in America, particularly in New York at this time, which was intensely competitive.
Yes.
And was one of the features of the newspaper at the time was the person who was the editor essentially wrote the whole thing.
That's right.
It was a very much a personal kind of expression of one person's viewpoints and attitudes and abilities and talents. If you had a paper, essentially, it was, you know, you might have stolen things here and there and rewritten stories from other papers, and there was a lot of advertising and other kinds of news. But in terms of real original editorial content, it was essentially it was one person doing it, and for that reason. it was very intense and personal business, and that's where we get into the dueling journalists aspect of the subtitle.
That's right. Well, you know, I didn't talk about this in the book, but it was almost like blogs today. You know, there was really, you know, each of these papers was really more or less a one-man show. The papers of the time were, of course, very different than the papers of today. They were only 4 pages long, And of those pages, only one page was actually a news page, and it wasn't the front page. It was inside on page 2. Page 2 was the news page. The front was reserved entirely for advertisements. So there was just one page of news, and that was pretty much all written, or at least selected, by the editor of the paper. You know, he wrote most of the articles. He chose the letters for publication. He often responded to the letters himself. You know, he advised his readers on, you know, not just who to vote for, of course, but also, you know, what shows to see and what books to read, what foods to eat, and so forth. You know, his personality was really, you know, a paper's fortunes rose and fell on the personality of the editor. And as a result, these guys were really kind of larger-than-life figures. They were something, you know, they were the first media celebrities, really. They were big men around town. You know, they were very vain, egotistical, arrogant guys, and intensely competitive. They really hated each other, a lot of them. And, you know, so much so that they often just beat each other up on the street when they happened to pass each other on the street. They got into fist fights if they didn't like something that one of the other papers had written about them in a recent editorial. You know, the editor of the largest paper in New York at the time, it was the Evening Post, was a poet, sort of a, you know, a gentle poet by the name of William Cullen Bryant in New York. Bryant Park today is named after him. He once horsewhipped a rival editor right on the streets of Broadway, right in front of City Hall, because he didn't like something that this guy had written about him in his paper. And indeed, these guys sometimes actually fought duels with each other, pistol duels with each other. A guy who was the editor of the largest morning paper, a guy named James Watson Webb, fought a duel with a congressman once, and he attacked the editor of another paper, the Herald, James Gordon Bennett, three times in a matter of weeks. The third attack so vicious that afterwards Bennett always kept a pair of loaded pistols in his office as self-defense. So when I refer to them as dueling journalists in the subtitle of the book, I mean that metaphorically, but also quite literally.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that at this time that in the city there were 11 daily papers, and that even though the city was a big city at the time, that the combined circulation, I suppose, and that goes back to the issue that they were expensive enough so that a lot of people wouldn't have been able to afford them. Their combined circulation was only something over 26,000.
That's right.
When this series ran in the Sun, what did that do for the circulation numbers for the Sun?
Well, by the time the series was over, the Sun had a let me say this. The largest paper up to this point in New York, the Evening Post, had a circulation of about 4,500. By the time the Sun series was over, the Sun circulation was 19,000. And indeed, by the following year, the Sun had a circulation that was larger than all of the other papers in New York City combined. So that's how popular this series made the Sun. This was the moment when people really kind of sat up and took notice and said, wow, this kind of paper, a penny paper meant for the common person, can really work. You can really turn a profit on a one penny paper. And this is the moment when you begin to see other penny papers begin to crop up, not just in New York, but all around the country. You know, the Cleveland Plain Dealer starts then, the Baltimore Sun, the New Orleans Times Picayune, the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, all of which continue to publish today. This was the moment, the 1830s and the 1840s, when America became for the first time a nation of newspaper readers. This is the moment when newspapers became for the first time a mass medium, and it really goes back to the initial success of the New York Sun, which in large part owed its success to the Moon Hoax.
Yeah, now, I don't want to denigrate the papers that you mentioned, because those are all newspapers with very good reputations. But it seems that indeed the kind of thing that we think of as the tabloid paper that still exists and many many names and many guises. This is really the birth of that style of paper and that style of journalism.
Well, sure, for both good and bad. Yeah. For both good and bad. But you know, when you think about a paper today, that's a local paper that has local news, that has a lot of sports, that has you know, a lot of crime stories, entertainment, gossip, and so forth. That, you know, that goes back to the Sun of Benjamin Day's time.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Matthew Goodman, and his book is The Sun and the Moon. The subtitle is The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man Bats in 19th Century New York. The book is published by Basic Books, and it is the story, as he has explained, the story of this so-called lunar hoax, the Great Moon Hoax. It was a series of articles that were published in the New York Sun newspaper in August 1835. Which revealed the stunning details of life on the moon, and it was great. It was a great story. It was hugely popular. People could not get enough of it. It was reprinted and circulated around the world and really established the Sun and started a kind of journalism that's still with us today. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, how was it revealed and in what way was it revealed that, in fact, that this was a hoax and that Richard Adams Locke had just made it up?
Right. Well, you know, there was a great deal of pressure on Richard Adams Locke in those days because, you know, these stories were really the talk of the town, everybody wondering, are they true, are they not true? And so, of course, a lot of speculation centered on Richard Adams Locke himself, since he was the editor of the paper in which these articles appeared, and people were saying to him, is it true, is it not true? Because presumably he would know the answer. Now, he felt, I think, I speculate in the book, that he was not really at liberty to reveal this because he had been paid quite well for this series, $300, I think between $300 and $500 a day, remembered later, that Benjamin Day had paid him for this series. And he felt that Benjamin Day had purchased the rights to these articles, much as, you know, he might purchase you know, a barrel of rum or molasses or something, and that he wasn't really at liberty to reveal the secret, that it was up to Benjamin Day to do that. But the pressure on him really was enormous. And one night, this is now in September, he was out drinking. Richard Adams Locke was something of a drinker. And he was out drinking one night at a hotel in New York with a rival editor, a friend of his who worked for a rival paper, a guy named Finn. And that guy mentioned that his paper was about to start running the series on their front page. I should point out that most of the other papers in town, or many of them anyway, began to publish the series on their own front pages, not wanting to miss out on the excitement. There were no, you know, copyright laws and so forth at that time. They simply reprinted the series word for word on their front pages. And so Finn mentioned to Locke that that they were going to run the series themselves. Locke, who I think his tongue had been loosened somewhat by drink, said to Finn, "Don't print it. I wrote it myself." And Finn, rather than take this as sort of a word to the wise from a fellow editor, from an old friend, rather than that, he took it as a scoop. And the Journal of Commerce, which was the paper he wrote for, revealed this information in their pages the next day. Locke admits having written the hoax, and that's how it all finally came out. Although the Sun never actually admitted it in print that they had in fact made up the series themselves.
So, in the reaction, were people angry having been duped, or did they just sort of laugh and say,
no,
"Well, that was
no,
a pretty good story"?
As I mentioned earlier, they were not angry about it. Many of the Sun's rivals predicted that the Sun, people would turn against the Sun, against the proprietors of the Sun, as, you know, liars and hoaxers and swindlers and so forth. But that never happened. People were really delighted by how well the Sun had pulled the wool over their eyes and how well this series had been done. people had really very different views of what a newspaper was supposed to be in those days. You know, the idea of this sort of objective truth that we expect from newspapers today really didn't come until later in the century. So people did not turn against the Sun. They continued to read the Sun just as they had before. The Sun circulation kept rising. And as I mentioned, by the following year, they had a circulation that was as much as all the other papers in town combined.
Mm. There's another character here I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about, maybe one of the more interesting and stranger people in the history of American letters.
Yes.
And that would be Edgar Allan Poe.
That's right.
Talk about his connection here.
Yeah, he's another one of the major characters in the story. And I have to say that, you know, when I began researching the story, I just thought it was a great tale. But as I delved deeper and deeper into it, I became more and more amazed at all of the incredible characters and incredible digressions that the story gets into. And you know, one of the characters is Edgar Allan Poe. Now, Edgar Allan Poe was then a young writer living in Richmond, Virginia, who was the editor of the Southern Literary Messenger, a literary magazine. Just 2 months earlier, in June of 1835, he had published a short story called Hans Fall, a Tale, that imagined a balloon trip to the moon and was full of all kinds of scientific detail. Poe himself, like Richard Adams Locke, was an astronomy buff. A lot of people don't know this, but he was very interested in astronomy. And he had, in fact, read that year a book about astronomy written by none other than Sir John Herschel. And inspired by that, had written this book imagining what a balloon trip to the moon would be like, and then describing the creatures that the hero encounters upon his arrival on the surface of the moon. Well, 2 months later, the Sun comes out with its moon series featuring none other than John Herschel. Well, Poe, who was, needless to say, this very vain, insecure, intensely competitive writer, was convinced that the Sun had plagiarized his idea for their own series, and he was irate about the success of the Sun series compared to the relative obscurity of his own story. He spent years railing against the Sun series, trying to point out all of the scientific errors of that series. And 9 years later, when he moves to New York to live in 1844, his very first order of business, the very first day that he arrived in New York, was to march over to the Sun offices on Nassau Street and plant his own hoax in the pages of the Sun to prove his superiority as a hoaxer once and for all.
You know, you would think here that this would have really established Richard Adams Locke, and or at least been the foundation for him going on from that point to be an important figure either in newspapering or in writing fiction, or both. What happened to him after all of this?
Right. Well, things didn't go very well for Richard Adams Locke after that, sadly enough. He was a very talented guy, very talented newspaper man. But unfortunately, he became known really as a hoaxer. He became known as the man in the moon. That was the nickname that people had given him. And he never really was able to shake that idea of himself as a hoaxer, which had not been his intention at all. He ended up leaving the Sun the following year. He got into a fight with Benjamin Day over money. He began to drink more heavily. He started a penny paper of his own a couple of years later called The New Era, a radical paper with a scientific bent. He lasted a few years there and then got into a fight with the publishers over politics, and he was fired, became subsequently the first editor of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, but he only lasted a year there. That position would eventually be taken by a young Brooklyn poet by the name of Walt Whitman. And eventually he left journalism entirely and stopped writing at all, as far as anybody can tell, and spent the last 20 years of his working life at the United States Customs House inspecting ships' cargoes. That was a common spot for writers who were down on their luck. Herman Melville was there for many years as well. And he moved to Staten Island, and where he's buried today, and nothing more was heard from him again. But he was really, as I'm convinced, a great man, if a somewhat unfulfilled man, and unquestionably a great writer. His editorials for The Sun were really marvels of the craft of newspaper writing, especially the ones against slavery. And the lunar hoax, the great moon hoax articles, the moon series, was really a marvelous literary production, really a wonderful literary production that people at the time compared to Swift, Jonathan Swift and Daniel Defoe. He deserves, Richard Adams Locke deserves to be far better remembered today than he is. And if my book does anything to restore his good name, I would be quite happy for that to be the case.
Well, certainly the story was good for The Sun. The Sun went out of business in 1950, but still, that's, you know, 120 years or something like that. That's a pretty good run.
Yep, yep. That's right. The Sun continued for a long, long time. You know, the famous newspaper editorial, Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus, that was the New York Sun, and they continued, you know, well into the 20th century. It became the Evening Sun in 1920. It had been the Morning Sun up to that point. But it continued well on until 1950, when it merged with the World Telegram, became the World Telegram and Sun, and then continued until 1966, when it finally expired. So it had a run of 133 years, which is a pretty decent run for a little newspaper.
Yeah. Well, just down to the point, we have a minute or two left. I guess also one thing that this story makes me think about or reminds me is that for some reason, I'm not exactly sure what, and maybe you have some feeling about it, this particular time in America is really appealing. And maybe it's because so many odd and wacky things happened, and that, you know, the 19th century, particularly the post-war era, the era after the Civil War,
right,
is a very interesting time in America. But, you know, so is the pre-war period. It's just, it seems the 1800s in America just as it seems an endlessly fascinating time.
I totally agree with that. I love the 19th century. I was really pleased to be able to write about the 1830s, particularly about New York in the 1830s. I mean, the city of New York is really one of the major characters in my story. Really what I tried to do, you know, I should mention that everything in the book is true. You know, it's written in sort of novelistically to try to bring the story alive. But every bit of it is true. And the city of New York really is a major character in the story. A lot had been written about New York in later periods. You know, the Gangs of New York was the 1850s. The Alienist was, you know, the 1890s. There's been some written about New York during the Revolutionary period earlier, but the 1830s was sort of virgin territory for a writer, and it was a fascinating time, really in the history of the country. I mean, this is when Andrew Jackson was president. There was this democratizing trend going on in the society. It was the time of hoaxes, as we had mentioned earlier. But it was also really the time when New York became New York, you know, when it really became the largest city in the country, when it became recognizable to us as New York. It was when immigrants first began to arrive in the city, when you began to hear foreign languages on the streets of New York for the first time, when New York became the media center, the media capital of the country, the entertainment center, when the garment industry began in New York, when New York became a great shipping port, you know, when it really became not just one city among many, but really the leading city in the country. It was a noisy place, you know, a smelly place, an incredibly boisterous, rollicking, you know, wild kind of town, and I hope I was able to bring that alive in the book.
Yeah. Well, for people who would like to sample it, again, the book is The Sun and the Moon, The subtitle is The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man Bats in 19th Century New York. It is by our guest Matthew Goodman, and it's published by Basic Books. It is a good story, so I'd say people should take a look at it. And Mr. Goodman, to you, we say thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it was my great pleasure. Thanks so much.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focused 580 Archives. We first broadcast the show on January 6th. Now, many past shows from Focus, other programs, the Afternoon Magazine, in fact, all of our local production is available for you to listen to anytime you are ready. Just go to our website. That's will.illinois.edu, and you will find out everything that you need to know. And of course, you can check out the schedules there, find out programs that will be upcoming. If you have comments on things that you hear on the station, you can make your comments that way. A lot of information available there on programming for WILO radio and TV. So that's Will, W-I-L-O, will.illinois.edu. The broadcast today is made possible by Carle Foundation Hospital. Carle Foundation Hospital provided more than $80 million in community benefit last year, including almost $10 million in free or discounted care. More information about how Carle embraces its charitable mission is in its annual report at carle.org. A reminder that tomorrow morning on the program, in the first hour, we'll be talking with Shamita Dasgupta. She is co-founder of Manavi Incorporated. She's a professor of law at New York University School of Law in New York. She'll be visiting the campus. We'll talk about domestic violence and sexual abuse in the Asian communities, both abroad and here in the United States. Then in the second hour, our guest is Andrea Tone. She is an historian. She teaches at McGill University. That's in Toronto, in Canada. And we'll be talking about a book that she's authored that looks at the history of tranquilizer use in the United States. Back in the 50s, when the first tranquilizer, Milltown, was released, the drug companies who made it, they weren't sure that there'd actually be any demand for it. But in fact, demand was very rapid in taking off. And at one point, so many people wanted this medication that pharmacies were actually running out, and they'd have to put up a sign that said, "We'll have more Milltown tomorrow." We'll talk about why it is it became so important, how it affected the practice of psychology, and perhaps also led to the development of a lot of other similar medications. And she talks about all of this in her book, The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. That's tomorrow, hour number two. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Sitting in today as host for Celeste Quinn is Jay Pierce.
Well, thank you very much, David. And coming up in the noon hour, of course, we'll have our usual mix of news and information. Have the weather update for you, etc., BBC News. And then in the 1 o'clock hour, we'll dip into the archives and go back to a March interview that Celeste did with David Gran, a staff writer at The New Yorker, about his book, The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. That'll be coming up in the 1 o'clock hour this afternoon. Let's take a look at how the commodity prices are doing in Kansas City right now. May wheat is trading at 604 and a quarter. It's down 3 and a quarter. July at 615 is down 2 and 3 quarters. The May wheat contract at 557 is down 6 and 1 half. July wheat in Chicago, these are the Chicago prices here, 569 down 6 and 3 quarters. And September at 597 is down 3 and a half. May corn at 404 is down 1 half. July at 414 down 3 quarters. September at 422 and a half down 1. And December at 434 and 3 quarters down 3 quarters. May soybeans 992 down 3 and a half. July at 991 and a half down 3 and 3 quarters. August up a quarter at 977. And September unchanged at 937. Soybean meal for May at 306 is unchanged. May soybean oil at 34.84 is down 48. July at 35.10, also down 48. Over on the mercantile, the April live cattle 86.12 and a half, up 7 and a half. And June live cattle 84.15, down 2 and a half. April feeder cattle 95.90, up 50. May at 97.05, up 35. Lean hogs for April at 60.10, down 17 and a half, and for May at 72.75, down 115. Frozen pork bellies for May 89.72 and a half, up 90, and for July at 88.40, up 2.75. And as we take a look at the current Dow Jones Industrial number, it's 7887, 7887, and that's down 130. The NASDAQ at 1587.5 is down 34, and the S&P 500 at 826 is down 16.5. 34 degrees, our present temperature on Friends Plaza outside of Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, AM 580 and FM 90.9. HD2 and HD3 Urbana. We also stream live at will.illinois.com.